Okay, let me thank the organizers for accepting my invitation to talk. Okay, I'd like to start by telling you what question I'm going to be asking in this talk. And the question is, how does brain tag an arbitrary point in a high-dimensional space? And I'm going to take a little bit of time to say what a tag is and what a point in a high-dimensional space is. Okay, a tag is a collection of neurons that respond to a particular stimulus specifically. So, for example, a face. And if you had a neurons that responded to a face, that would be a face tag. I'll talk a little bit more about tags later. In fact, that's what the whole talk is going to be about. What's a point in high-dimensional space? We do a lot of business with points in high-dimensional space, and I'll give you an example. So one of the ways that the computers are getting really good these days at doing face recognition, in some circumstances they're about as good as we are, and one of the ways that they work is by measuring off a lot of points in the space. And so, for example, you could have a point. I just had my eraser on. You could have a point that would be that length there, and so I can plot it here. This would be the nose length. And you could have another point that was the distance between the eyes. That would be the eye point. And there's going to be a point in space that it characterizes those, and every individual would have those two points that are different. Then, if you had a third axis, which might be the width of the mouth, you could put this here, and then this point, then that would be a point in the three-dimensional space. So every point you could measure would be a point in a space with a number of points in it. And so I can't draw it after this, but you'd have maybe 50 points is what the face would give you. So that would be a point in a 50-dimensional space. Now, there are 7 billion faces in the world. We have to be able to generate a tag for any one of those faces almost instantly, and then we can use that tag to learn where the, thank you, we can use that tag to do learning to put in a name on that face. And so we know that we can recognize and name, you might forget the name, but you can learn to recognize a face very, very quickly. And in order to do, but you have to have a tag generated for every single of the 7 billion faces in the world so that you could learn them. Now, there are a couple of really important properties for tags. One of them is that a tag should be based on all of the information that the animal has available. These are properties of good tags. You wouldn't want a tag where you threw away a lot of the information, because then it wouldn't let you discriminate as well as you could conceivably. The second property is tags should be specific. That means that they shouldn't that they shouldn't overlap with other tags. So in general, a tag is going to be a collection of cells. You want the tags to be as small as possible, but there has to be quite a few of them to get rid of noise and things like that. And it's clear that not all tags can be different. So, you know, if you have two faces that people look very similar, you can even tell if they're similar. They say, well, those people look like they're related. But they have, and you might get them confused. And a lot of people who have trouble doing face recognition, there's a wide range of abilities for this. And a lot of people will confuse faces. If you have them together, they can tell them apart, but they can't remember them very well. So no, tags are not always specific. They do overlap, but you'd like the tags to be generated in a way that they were as little overlapping as possible. Okay, those are the two tags. Now, oh, that's funny. Okay, something got lost, but that's okay. So let me give you an example of a tag. This is a picture of Jennifer Aniston. And I actually don't even know who Jennifer Aniston is, but I know she's quite famous. And there was an experiment where they were recording for a surgeon named Itzhak Fried, in collaboration with Christoph Koch, was recording, doing depth recording in epilepsy patients to locate where the lesion was. And they made probes that they could record from individual cells or sometimes groups of cells. And they did the experiment where they showed people lots of pictures of famous people or relatives or something like that. And they recorded from the cells. They also showed famous buildings like the White House or the Leaning Tower of Pisa. They also showed some animals like an elephant and a spider and a dog. And they showed these people the pictures, and what they found is they could run across cells, a lot of them in the hippocampus, they could run across cells that would respond specifically to one face. And this and one of the cells, the most famous one, or one of the most famous ones, was the Jennifer Aniston cell, because this woman who obviously didn't know who Jennifer Aniston was would respond to her face, but not to other people's faces. And here's just an example of three faces right here, three pictures of Jennifer Aniston. They don't look all the same. They're all quite different, but below here is right across here are spike trains that were recorded from these cells. They almost didn't fire spikes otherwise, and this is the spike frequency. And and out of the 100 cells or something like that, they showed this person. This is the only one the only cell that would fire for Jennifer Aniston. They also had cells that fired for the White House, the Leaning Tower of Pisa, spiders, all sorts of things like that. So these cells, I would argue, are one cell out of a collection that are a tag for a particular face. So these things do, in fact, exist. Now I am going to be talking about the fly nervous system, and the question is, you know, why? I'd like to study this problem, and the question is, how are you going to study it? And I believe that the fly olfactory system is the easiest place to study it, and the reason is that it's known that there is a combinatorial code, which is a specifies a point in a high-dimensional space. And the combinatorial code for the fly is 50-dimensional because it has 50 odorant receptor genes and 50 receptor types for them. The code is formulated, I'm going to go over this again, and most of you know this better than I do. The code is formulated by the antenna lobe, and then the antenna lobe projects to the mushroom body Kenyon cells, and there are 2,000 Kenyon cells. Those 2,000 Kenyon cells form select out of all the 2,000 cells, they select about 100, about 5% of the 2,000 that fire robustly, and and that is a tag for that odor. The tag for that odor is then used by the fly to learn about the odor, and if you have a neutral odor, or even a non-neutral odor, you can teach the fly to avoid that odor, or to approach it, to find it, to have a valence, and that is done in the lobes of the mushroom body, making use of that tag, and the stuff that Glenn was talking about today was a part of the process for attaching that tag to a valence. And so I decided that maybe the best place to look at this problem would be in the fly, because we know so much about the fly system. We know more about the particular architecture of the fly system, which I'll talk about in a minute, than we do any other system with that architecture. And it's the simplest version of it, and so much is known, and you can do experiments or everything you need to do with it. And so that seems like the best place to solve this problem, to solve one version of this problem. And the hope is that maybe other systems that you will use the same trick, other systems with the same architecture, who are solving the problem of attaching a tag to a point in a high-dimensional space, maybe they also will use the same trick. You have to start someplace, and you might as well start someplace where it's not going to be exactly the final solution, but it may be something that's a part of the solution. Okay. This is a theory talk, although you won't see any equations, and I have done no experiments with the fly, and it's pure theory, and all I did is read other people's literature and make use of that, and I'll tell you some of those things. Mainly, I mean, I read more papers than this, but mainly the papers that I did read came from Richard Axel's lab. The ones that I'm basing what my talk on came from Richard Axel's lab, from Glenn Turner's lab, and from Rachel Wilson's lab. Not all the papers, just certain specific ones that I'm going to be talking about today, and you'll hear about those, some of those as I go along. I made two contributions to this problem. The first one is the property of the tag. The tag being based on all possible information. But that's not going to, if I talk about that, it's not going to fit in half an hour. So I'm not going to talk about that. The second contribution I made, if I did, is the idea of how is the tag How is the tag made to be specific? And so that's all I'm going to be answering. I'm going to say, how is it that a tag is generated to be specific and not how it's based on all the information? Okay, so let me go over this. Most of you know, as I say, know this better than I do, but there are probably a few people who wandered in who don't read the fly literature, and they may be a little vague on parts of it, and so I'm going to go over the parts that I need. The fly literature, the fly has this is a skeleton of the architecture of the first two stages, central stages of the fly olfactory architecture. These are the olfactory receptor neurons. There are actually around 2,000 of them that fall in 50 categories with 50 genes, and I'll write that down here, 2,000. And each of those 2,000 sends their axons to one of 50 glomeruli, and the glomeruli are neuropil regions that where all of the axons from one particular type of olfactory receptor neuron come. And this is the antenna lobe here, and that's where the glomeruli are, 50 of them. The antenna lobe has 50 projection neurons. There are actually more than 50, but they're all the same. All the ones from the same glomerulus behave the same way. So you can say there are 50. And these are the projection neurons here. And there are 50 of those. And then they go back to the calyx of the mushroom body. And in the calyx of the mushroom body, there are, and this is the mushroom body here. And in the calyx of the mushroom body, there are Kenyon cells. And there are 2,000 Kenyon cells. Now, there's some details that I'll tell you about this in just a second. The Kenyon cells send their outputs to three sublobes in the that are sticking down, and Glenn showed you a beautiful picture of the lobes of the mushroom body, and that's what he was talking about today. They send their axons out to mushroom body lobes. There's some circuitry in here that I have not drawn. In the antenna lobe, there is circuitry that made mainly of inhibitory neurons that go presynaptically to the terminals of the odorant receptor neurons and exert gain control. It's called divisive gain control. And about three different labs worked out the basic idea that gain control was there, but Rachel Wilson's lab was the one that worked out the most details and the deepest understanding of that. I didn't draw those in to keep it simple. Also, in the Kenyon cells, there is two things you need to know. The first thing you need to know that each Kenyon cell takes a random sample of the output from six glomeruli. It's not exactly six. It's not exactly random, but if you just believe that, that'll be okay, and we could discuss it if you care. So the each Kenyon cell takes six different glomeruli at random, and they may be overlapping between different Kenyon cells, of course. Also, there is on each side of the brain, there is one neuron called the APL neuron. And the APL neuron sends its dendrites down into the mushroom body lobes. The dendrites go here. The cell body is sitting outside. its axons go back up to calyx, where the Kenyan cells are, and there they make synaptic connections on all of the Kenyan cells. The APL neuron is an inhibitory neuron. It collects all the output and it subtracts it from all the input. And this is what's called a winner-take-all circuit, because it kills all the cells that have kills all the firing of cells that have a weak input, and lets only the cells with a strong input fire. And about 5% of the cells that are of the Kenyan cells are permitted to fire spikes, and those are the cells that have the strongest input. And so the way the tag is generated is the input from the antenna lobe comes to the Kenyan cells. It gets distributed over all the Kenyan cells in a random way. Then the Kenyan cells that get the strongest input are permitted to fire, and the rest don't fire, and the tag is formulated that way. All of the information available is available in the subsample of Kenyan cells that are permitted to fire. It's also available in the ones that aren't permitted to fire. So what the mushroom body Kenyan cells do is they look over and they find the best tag, and that's based on all the information and is most specific, and then they send that information out. So what the talk is about is how the Kenyan cells select the best ones to be a tag. Just in case I've skipped over stuff, because often I forget, are there any specific questions about anything I've said so far? You're all pretty familiar with it, so it should be okay, but I might have said something confusing. Okay.
I have a call.
Yes.
APL here.
Yes.
It also synapses on the mushroom body.
I'm sorry, it also does what? I still didn't quite hear the question.
APL, you told that APL synapses go only into the axons?
The dendrites are in the lobes. They collect the output of the Kenyan cells, and the axon goes back to the calyx and makes inhibitory synapses.
Yes, but it's very, very simplified. Okay. That's my comment only. This is simplified. These neurons also
Yes, it could be. I don't know. Yeah. But it does matter that it synapses on the Kenyan cells. Okay. Actually, we're almost done. Okay. The one part of the theory has to do with why a small set of Kenyan cells have all the available information coming to them. I'm not going to talk about that. The other part of the theory has to do with the nature of the combinatorial code, and that's going to be the trick. The nature of the combinatorial code, you can guess what it maybe should be. And what it maybe should be is what people who are interested in information call a maximum entropy code. Most of you don't find this an especially charming term. And if I tried to explain how the theory works for that, it would take too long, and you don't even need to know how the theory works or where it came from, just to know that it's a theory from information theory, that a maximum entropy code is a particular kind of code. There are actually a whole bunch of different kinds. The thing that you need to know is that the way that you characterize a maximum entropy code is the probability that if you pick an odor at random and you give it to the fly, that it will tell you what the firing rate is for any cell or any glomerulus. That's the way you characterize it. The way you would find out what maximum entropy code it has is you would record from all of the projection neurons in the antenna lobe. You'd find the firing rates for all the odors in the world. You'd make a histogram, and the histogram would tell you what the maximum entropy code is. It's going to be some distribution, some probability distribution. What's lucky is that Vikas, who talked yesterday afternoon, didn't do the right experiment, but he came pretty close. Instead of recording from all of the projection neurons, he recorded from about 10% of them. That's seven. He recorded from seven projection glomeruli projection neurons, and he didn't use all the odors in the world. He used 18 of them. But I had very little hopes that if I, and he published the paper. It was in a paper that came out in I think 2008, and in that paper, he showed a figure that had all the firing of all the cells, and I sent him an email asking him for his data. He sent me the data. I collected all the data together, and I plotted the histogram that should tell you what the maximum entropy code is, and that histogram is right here. And this is the maximum entropy code probability distribution, and it's an exponential. So you don't have to believe the theory. The theory actually predicts it should be an exponential because there's a certain condition that always gives you an exponential distribution for this. But all you have to do is believe Vikas' experiment. Okay, so that's all I'm going to use. Okay, how does it work? If you give any odor to any glomerulus, the probability that it will fire at a particular rate, is given by this. Most of the odors that you give to one glomerulus are down here. They don't make it fire very much. The only odors very few odors make it fire out here in this tail. If you give one odor and look across all the glomeruli, then the probability, the plot looks the same. Most of the glomeruli won't fire much. They all fire a little bit maybe, but most of them won't fire much. But rarely, one or a few glomeruli will fire a lot. The trick is, if I take an odor at random, and I give it, there'll be a few cells that fire very fast, a few projection neurons that fire fast. If I take another random odor and I give that one, there are going to be a few cells that fire fast, but they're very unlikely because it's rare for a cell to be made firing fast. So the chances are that if you have two separate random odors, that they will make two cells fire fast is very unlikely. Then when you go up here to the mushroom body, and this is the probability versus firing rate, each one of those Kenyan cells takes a random sample of six. Most of the Kenyan cells are going to be unlikely to get six fast-firing neurons. Only a very few are, and you can work out what the distribution is, and it's known what it is, but it's very close to a Gaussian. And the only cells and it's very rare for cells to make the Kenyan cells fire fast. And so if you use the APL neuron to kill the firing of all the cells except that few, that's going to be rarely going to happen. And so you're hardly ever going to have at random two overlapping odors, and that's the two overlapping tags that are generated, and that's the best you can do. Okay, so it couldn't be any simpler, really. The trick is that the way that the antenna lobe generates the combinatorial code is by making it rare for an odor to make the cell fire fast. The Kenyan cells make it even more rare because you're piling up probabilities, and the more low probabilities you have, the less likely it is it's going to happen with two different odors. And all it has to do is find the fastest firing cells, and that's it. Okay. That's my answer to how the Jennifer Aniston cells are generated. I have no idea. The other places where this happens, where this same architecture, you could call it the Marr architecture, because David Marr was the first person to describe a way it might work. The Marr architecture is found in the olfactory cortex. It's found in the cerebellum, which is where Marr first described it, and it's found in the hippocampus, as John pointed out this morning. I have no idea if the mammalian olfactory cortex works like this. I have no evidence one way or the other, or the hippocampus, or other places that generate tags tags for points in high dimensional space, but it's something you can look into and find out. Okay, thank you.
It's very interesting. Thank you. I would like to know how this APL neuron kill the other response.
How it does what?
Kill the most of weak response of the Kenyan cells.
Basically, most of the cells have a very small depolarization. Most of the cells, for most odors, are down in this half of the probability distribution. And the reason they are is they're putting out a lot of output. They're stimulating that neuron to fire. It goes back and subtracts the output from them, and only ones that have a big enough output that what's getting subtracted does not keep them from firing is just the 5% up here.
So I have back here. I have two questions. First, I was wondering if whether you have yet grown a Jennifer Aniston neuron, and my serious question is. I was wondering if you could talk about your perspective on randomness, because you alluded to the fact that critical aspects of the connectivity in this system have been argued to be random, and it's very difficult to distinguish almost random from random.
Yes.
And I'm wondering what your thought on the importance of that question is.
The question is important. The answer is it doesn't matter if it's really random or just seems like it's random. I didn't talk about that. That's another part of the theory. But there's a paper from Richard Axel's lab and Larry Abbott where they looked at a whole bunch of connections and showed statistically that they act as if their connections are made with the frequencies at which they would have if they were random, and random it can mean two things. It could mean they take them at random, but people often think of random as being uniform, which means that there's an equal chance for everything to be selected. They're definitely not uniform, and that's in Larry's paper, but they are quite random. But when you look into the details about the theory, the randomness is beside the point. It's just properties of a of a particular matrix that's there, the connection matrix between the projection neurons and the Kenyon cells. And there only has to be certain very common properties of that matrix to have it to have what I was saying work.
I'm here. Chuck, very beautiful talk, very interesting ideas. So I'm curious, you kind of mentioned that the tip of the distribution, the strongest glomerular strongest neurons actually make an impact, and they're actually essence of the tag that, you know, make Kenyon cells. What other cells are for? What information do they carry? What's the reason of their? What they telling the rest of the system?
What information theory?
So everything but important cells. What they're doing?
They're sitting there in reserve for making another tag that can be distinct. You have to have enough neurons to be able to make enough distinct tags for the animal to get along. A fly lives 2 weeks. If there are 1,000 neurons and there are 2,000 neurons and 100 tags in each 100 cells in each tag, then you could make 20 distinct tags.
Sure.
And evolution has figured out that flies don't need more than 20.
But they're firing, so do they tell anything to the next stages, or
they don't,
can ignore it?
They just sit there. They just sit there until they get an input that's big, and then they fire. And otherwise, they're just sitting there resting.
Yeah, so Chuck here.
Yes, sir.
Essentially, you need a coincident detection for the PNs to trigger a firing in the Kenyon cells, right? So it has to take more than one cell to trigger firing.
Not strictly speaking. If you make one Kenyon cell fire enough at a fast enough rate, then you could probably get a spike out. But usually the spike rates are quite high for the best inputs. They're quite high. There are roughly 300 spikes per second. And you do need more inputs. But usually the best would be if you had high firing coming in from 6 inputs. That would definitely work well.
So then it comes to the number. Each Kenyon cell receives input from 6 glomeruli.
Yeah.
And then you do the combinatorials. That combinatorial will be much larger than 2,000 cells. So would you be missing a lot of?
Well, no. It doesn't matter if you miss combinations. You just have to have enough coming in that are firing fast enough that go to the same Kenyon cell, and there'll always be 100 Kenyon cells that get the strongest input, and that's all you need.
So, so if I recall the story about the Jennifer Aniston cell correctly,
yeah.
And it's been a while since I've looked into that. If I remember correctly, that cell would fire to Jennifer Aniston in many circumstances, with one exception, and that was if she was standing next to Brad Pitt.
Yes.
Sort of the olfactory analog of that, the more serious question is, you know, essentially, how do models like this work with respect to noisy stimuli and especially mixtures? Especially, let's say you have a tag that's, you know, a clear tag for one stimulus, you have a clear tag for another one. And as you essentially form linear combinations of the stimuli, do you see sudden transitions in the sort of representation of the combined stimulus, or are there sort of is it a smoothly graded thing? And you know, if Glenn wants to chime in on this point experimentally, if you have data on this point, I'd be interested in that too. So, but both how the model that you're working with behaves under such circumstances.
Okay.
And
I can say in general how it behaves, but the mathematics and the theory that it's an analytic theory. And the mathematics, it's probabilistic, and so it does not lend itself well to looking at, well, if there's so much overlap, how well can you tell? How different would they be? And in general, if two tags are identical, then they're going to have the same response. If two tags are totally distinct, then they're going to have totally distinct they'll be totally distinct responses to them. But when they're overlapping, then you're sometimes going to confuse them. That's something that you can look into, but it's not suited well for the approach I used. So what we're doing is Shyam Srinivasan, who's here, is making a computer model that'll let us explore all of these things. There's some nice things to explore, to look at odor mixtures, for example, and see how well the fly can distinguish between odor mixtures, or how well they would generalize from one odor to another when they're quite similar.
Yes, I'm trying to think about your inhibitory feedback here from the APLs.
Yep.
And is the feedback, I guess, in a way, is it weaker than the excitation that's coming out, or how is it that those really strongly firing guys don't pull your inhibition way up to the point
they
where
do.
It would
they do.
Block?
But they don't. But they don't pull it up. But if they stop firing, then the inhibition goes away. So what happens is that you average the inhibition for everything, and then you subtract that average, and there are going to be some cells and the ones that survive are the ones that don't have that have more excitation than they do inhibition from everything that comes back.
So I guess in a way then you would think of that interneuron as having like a narrower range than
the
excitation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Are there any more questions?
Okay.
Thank you, Chuck.